Hello, this is Kristy Safarova. Welcome to another episode of the Strategy Skills Podcast. Our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It is a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you're preparing for interviews and want to improve your resume, you can get McKinsey and BCG winning resume. It is also a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Rebecca Homkes. She is a high growth strategy specialist, something any business wants. And she's a lecturer at the London School of Business, Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship, faculty at Duke Corporate Executive Education, and advisor and faculty at Boston Consulting Group University. Welcome, Rebecca.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
Rebecca, so I know that you look a lot in your work into how leaders can lead their companies to great success and contribution to the world. And you look a lot at uncertainty. So I was thinking we can get into all those topics, so much to explore. But maybe before we do that, just to set some context, maybe you could give us a quick overview of how you ended up even doing this work.
Yeah, absolutely. Very happy to. So as you mentioned, I specialize in high growth strategy. So I focus on developing, executing, and innovating on strategy. So especially for organizations that want to grow very quickly. So usually doubling in growth every strategy cycle. And I kind of fell into this, which I think a lot of people do. It wasn't something that I thought I would always do. I started out, I actually was an intern at Bain as my very first job. And then I was about to work for McKinsey in Washington, D.C. And then I got a Marshall Scholarship and I moved to London and got my PhD at the London School of Economics. And while I was there, I was able to run a global project between McKinsey and the London School of Economics. So I kind of got fully immersed in measuring and quantifying and talking about leadership and management and organizational performance. And so after I finished my PhD, instead of moving back to America, I ended up going to the London Business School and met a colleague, and we applied those same things I had been doing to strategy and strategy execution. So I got to start teaching at the London Business School in our executive program and working with several YPO companies, which is the Young Presidents Organization, and working with so many entrepreneurs from a very young age. You know, some of my very first teaching that I did, I was able to just be thrown into the world. And I thought, Chris, I wanted to focus on strategy execution, right? Because I had a PhD in economics, right? And I really wanted to kind of get into the guts of execution. And I learned from very early days, you can't have great conversations about execution without great conversations about strategy. So I had to kind of walk back in the value chain, if you will. And then I really fell into the sweet spot that I'm quite passionate about, which is how can you consistently build strategies and execute them for growth, especially when you're facing extreme levels of uncertainty. So now I spend about 20% of my time at the business schools and the rest working directly with organizations who want to sign up and commit to a high growth organization.
Very, very interesting area to focus on. So let's just step back a little bit. You went very quickly through your very interesting career. And many of our listeners, they are working for major consulting firms. And some of them never worked, but they are senior people within other organizations, huge organizations. And many of them are wondering what it is like to be a consultant at Bain, to be a consultant at McKinsey, and what are the differences. You worked at both. Maybe you could give us an overview.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, I worked at Bain quite a very long time ago, right? So right out of university, which was many years ago now, Chris. And I worked at McKinsey as a partner, right? A partner with some of them as we were working on this research institute between McKinsey and the London School of Economics. And now I work with some great colleagues at the Boston Consulting Group in their corporate university. So I've had the pleasure of working with all three. And all of them have incredible strengths and incredible people. And really the difference is going to come down to which industry or practice group that you want to specialize in and work in and kind of what office you want to live in. So there's probably more similarities than differences across the three firms. And it really does come down to individuals where you want to specialize and focus in terms of, again, client group or geography or functional expertise.
And then when you went into academia, was it a culture shock for you?
A little bit, I have to say, after some time with Bain and McKinsey, then going to do a PhD, it was a little bit of a transition to kind of go from that frenzy of life and lifestyle to that of a PhD. But I was very lucky that I was less than a month into my PhD when one of my professors at the London School of Economics said, "Hey, like, you know, consulting, right?" And I said, "Yeah, like, why?" And he said, "Well, you know, McKinsey and LSE are partnering on this project and they need someone who knows consultants and economists. And you're the only one I know who knows both. So will you come over and help us?" So I was able to spend several years on this project, got to learn a ton and run this global project for several years. And what we were trying to do, Chris, was understand, are better managed firms more productive? And that sounds silly. You think, well, certainly a better managed firm would be more productive, but we never really measured it before. So with a team, we actually built a study, and it was a quantitative study that we made qualitative. And we trained teams of MBAs all around the world who would call plant managers and interview them about their plant's productivity. And then we would score them on a rubric and start to get a sense of if management in terms of talent management and performance management and target management led to more productivity. And the answer is it does, and it does so dramatically. And this was 2008 and 2009. So we're going into a global economic crisis, and we've got a very powerful message for governments all around the world that you've got an incredibly cost-efficient, capital-light way to boost GDP, and that's helping your plant managers understand basic management. So yes, academia was a culture shock, but I managed, Chris, to transition it back to my sweet spot of some metrics and working on teams and doing all the things that I knew how to do very well.
And it is such a good example of how all our experiences matter, and they become very useful and create opportunities for us when we least expect. I remember when I just started in consulting, a big break for me was I was able to get in my free time on a project that I only was able to get on because of my knowledge of basically Russian language and also understanding of the culture and so on. And then just getting that opportunity and then building from there. And your example is also beautiful because you were able to get that opportunity because of your background.
Absolutely. And I think I've heard many of your guests say the same thing. You can never really plot out your career pathway looking forward. And I think people who try to sketch out their 20, 30 year pathway from age 18 or 22 often set themselves back. I think if you remain heads up and just say yes, you'll end up having a much kind of different and more powerful career pathway. And I was able to do that. You know, if you would have told me 20 years ago, I'd be running my own consulting firm and teaching at two universities, I would have said, no, like I've got this other pathway, but I absolutely love what I do. And it happened because, again, I just said yes and put myself open to opportunities as they happened along the way.
And would you say that being a professor is a better fit for you or more enjoyable in some way than being a consultant at the major firm?
It is for me, yeah, in a different way, is that I like very, very practical academics. So I only teach in our executive program. So I don't teach our degree programs, our MBAs, Chris. I only work in our executive classroom. And what I tell people in the classroom is that, look, we're not going to do anything in this classroom that I didn't do yesterday and won't do tomorrow working directly with the team. We are only going to do things that I know that work in the real world. And if you can give that message, right, to the CEOs and executives in the room, that we're going to be practical, you're going to walk away with something. And like, I've been battle tested too, and we're going to get through this together. It's quite powerful. And so I love academia with that lens, right? It's kind of this very practical, active learning approach. And so again, I spend a small percentage of my time there in the classroom, and then most kind of working directly with teams, but you're always teaching and learning, right? So even when we're doing advising or consulting with organizations, there's a bit of teacher, there's a bit of learner, there's a bit of partner, right? There's a bit of coach, there's a bit of tough love. As I often say many, many times, you've got to do that as well. And it's about bringing all of these different things together.
Rebecca, and when you started teaching executives, what surprised you? Maybe some areas that were especially difficult that you did not expect, it, anything that stood out for you that you did not expect?
You know, I think everything surprises you when you do it the first time. I think what surprised me the most was how little understanding of strategy there really is inside organizations. Strategy is one of those topics that we speak about a lot. Yet, if you ask even the same leadership team to define what strategy is, as I do, you know, quite frequently, they give you a different response back. And somehow along the way, we've lost some real core fundamentals of what this thing is. Now, I think that's partly because we almost shield people from it, right? We assume that there's operational people and strategic people, and you can't get involved in the strategy discussions until you've kind of risen your way up the career ladder. And then somehow we expect when people get there, them to be excellent at strategy, right? So I think that's part of the disconnect. But that for me was just realizing that you've really got to keep going more and more and more basic. And I think what I've really found helpful for me was to not try to make things hard, right? Is that we sometimes overcomplicate strategy and economics. And yes, you can. But what's much more powerful and helpful is say, it's actually pretty simple. There's only a couple of things that we need to take away. And, you know, that's where I go. I go back to the basics and I start every single conversation about strategy with defining it and make it super simple so we can all get on the same page. And then we go from there together.
And how would you define strategy for our listeners who are now thinking, maybe I'm not understanding it correctly?
Yeah. What's so funny, Kristen, ties back into uncertainty is that, you know, we keep having this conversation about everything's changed, right? Everything's different, new normal. I mean, how many times a day do we hear this? What I think is really cool and refreshing is that, yes, in this environment of 2024 where everything's changing, the definition of strategy has not. It's the same thing it's always been, and that's value creation, right? Strategy is an articulation of how your organization creates value, and that's it. Strategy is value creation. All value creation is driving the biggest gap possible between two things. On one hand, your customers or clients' willingness to pay for your products, services, and solutions. On the other hand, your total cost of getting it to them. So strategy is just about moving these two levers apart, client or customer willingness to pay and total cost of getting it to them. And if you can keep that anchor that all we're trying to do is move these two things apart, the whole world actually dramatically simplifies and buckets into two things. You're in needle up, like increase willingness to pay. You're in needle down, reduce cost. Or you do both. But what you find, Chris, is that the majority of things you do aren't really moving the needle. And then those are the things that we need to move aside. So as a leadership team, we can focus on those few things that really will make a difference.
And now that we are defining things, let's also define uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you asked this. This is one of my big hangups about the current environment that we're in, is that this was something before COVID. Is I realized this several years ago. Again, it's not when COVID happened. And you probably noticed it too. And I want you to start listening to it for me now, okay? Is that when we talk about the word uncertainty, we almost always put a word before it that means it's going to be bad, right? We ask each other, how are we going to manage uncertainty? How are we going to overcome uncertainty? How are we going to get on through uncertainty? And we talk about it with recent graduates too, but how are they going to deal with career uncertainty, right, in the current job market? And we frame it as bad. So we got to start by defining that too. So the definition of uncertainty, also quite simple. It's a series of future events which may or may not occur. Whether or not those events are good or bad depends on what we're trying to do and how we're set up. So whether you're running an organization or trying to kind of kickstart your career, your job is to figure out what you're trying to do and then get set up, right? Because all this uncertainty is a series of future events which may or may not occur. Our job isn't to predict them because we can't. Again, it's just to get set up to do the best regardless of how those events pan out.
That is so true. We think about uncertainty as something negative, but it doesn't have to be at all. So as humans, what is our natural response to uncertainty?
I think as human beings, we don't like uncertainty, and we need to acknowledge that. And there's psychological reasons why. Like, we don't like uncertainty because it makes us nervous or apprehensive. And a lot of that comes because we can't predict the future, right? We want to be able to predict the future, and we can't. And so we kind of get this almost this paralysis, right? Because we feel that we can't make a decision until we know more. So we end up just waiting and waiting until the future is clear and we can make a decision. And so you've got to acknowledge a couple of things. You know, one, you can't predict the future. Just acknowledge that. And the second reason uncertainty really gets to us is because it affects our ability to make great decisions, right? Because we can't predict the future, and because this feeling, this overhang of that makes us uncomfortable, like we almost get this emotive feeling about it. And so the trick is not to try to predict the future. Again, I'm going to repeat again and again, because we can't. It's about working with your team to make better decisions, even though we can't make great predictions. So your first reframe is uncertainty is just the future. And your second reframe is we're not going to spend time trying to predict the future. We're going to spend time trying to make better decisions, even though we can't make great predictions.
And another thing that is happening is leaders do not spend sufficient time paying attention to what is happening, where are we going, how things are changing. And so many companies go out of business or really lose their ground because they were not looking at where are we going, what will likely to happen 5-10 years from now, and are we ready for that? Are we building the company in the right way towards that future?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about what it takes to consistently grow through uncertainty, and we make a lot of mythology around this, right? And it's really, I codified it. It's this three-part process I call survive, reset, thrive. Is, yes, you've got to stabilize. There's going to be continued market shocks that hit us, right, Chris? You're going to have COVID. You're going to have recession. You're going to have surprise election results, right, which might happen in 2024, given the amount of elections that we have. And you've got to stabilize. But then you've got to be prepared to reset or change. And then you can be a thrive organization again. Now, another thing that's very popular in, you know, popular lexicon or the conference circuit is that phrase, you know, you've got to survive to thrive, or don't just survive, thrive. And we saw this a lot after COVID. And there's something wrong with that statement, that it misses the reset, is that if you just survive, but you're not prepared to reset or change, you won't get to thrive. And that's the biggest reason that we see this, is that change is hard, right? Change is hard for individuals, and it's harder for organizations, right? And very few leadership teams are willing to say, yes, to go forward and thrive, we're going to have to change a lot of what we're doing. And that's why we see so few organizations who consistently outperform through different market cycles, because they're the ones with the guts and the boldness to say, we're going to reset. And that word reset, wow, it's emotional, right? I mean, so many leaders will say to me, yeah, we want to do a new strategy process, but can we not use the word reset? Because I don't want to trigger the team. And, you know, my team wants to do this, but we want to use the word revisit or relook at. We don't want to use the word reset. Like, we have actually built up this emotional resistance to the word reset. And I'm trying to just normalize it again and say change is great, because we all know we're in a world that's changing. So why don't we know that we need to run organizations that might need to change and adapt as well?
Very true. So let's break down each of them: survive, reset, thrive. What do you feel is important to say about each of those?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the first thing is that they go together as a three-part loop, right, Chris? Is that growth is a loop, not a line. And I know that sounds silly, but going back to our human brain, like, we like to think that everything is linear, like a checklist. We get through the survive phase, we get through the reset phase, and then we're thriving, and then things are going to be great and stay and thrive. And what I found is that it doesn't actually work like that, right? You can go through those phases and you can be thriving, and you're going to go back to reset. And one of the first things about doing well, if you want to be a thrive organization, and I'm assuming all of your listeners want to be part of one of these thrive organizations, is acknowledge that you're going to go back to survive sometimes. And acknowledging that this is a loop, not a line, is the most powerful thing that you need to do. Now, another thing that I've really realized about the loop is, for larger organizations, it's very rare your whole organization goes through the same thing at the same pace. Now, you're going to have different geographies that are in different phases. You're going to have different business units in different phases. Now, you can be a leader in one business unit, but you're leading a much different stage than a colleague in another business unit. And companies that do better, and you start to see this, are ones that allow for these differentiated growth journeys. You know, organizations that insist on very centralized, you know, corporate planning and, you know, the same kind of way of tracking and updating and calendars, they're not letting, like, the time that their different units need in these different phases. So you've got to embrace those two things. It's a loop, right? Not a line. And just let different people move through it in the different stage. Now, I don't know if you're a parent, but I also kind of liken it to being a parent with three different kids, right? And they all need three different parenting styles. And you know this, right? You sometimes wonder, like, why isn't child A, like, reacting in the same way as child B? You've got to let kind of your different units go through this and spend the different time they need in these different phases. And then when you get into survive, again, acknowledge it. I've actually had this conversation two times today, is that the first step of being in survive is actually standing up and saying, we're in survive mode right now, and that's okay. And here's what we're going to do to be in it. But you've got to have that emotional courage as a leader to acknowledge that this is the mode that we're in. But yes, we're going to have a pathway that's going to take us out of survive and into some of the other phases.
Could we maybe give an example of a company going through those phases?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's talk a little bit about survive. Is that, you know, survive can happen because of a macro shock. Like, many organizations went through survive after COVID, and anything in the live event space, for instance, if you held big trade shows or you were in the concert space, you're going into survive after that, right? We're looking in the news at Boeing right now, who is certainly going back into the survive phase, kind of really needs to stabilize and then go back into a reset again, is taking that time. And in survive, I like to call them the five C's, because again, I like to make it as simple as possible. And those five C's are cash, cost, customers, communication, and culture. And they sound basic, but it's really hard to make sure all of them are back. But until you've stabilized across each of those five C's, you can't start moving out, right? Do you have a solid cash flow? Are your fixed costs low? Are you kind of clear on your customers? Are you communicating well to your employees in the outside world? And what about your culture is going to get you through? What about your culture needs to change, right, given the reset? But it's important to acknowledge those are just the basics. And what I've also found is that companies who just do the basics never move out of survive. you've also got to go into what I call the survive power moves. And there's a couple power moves that are really going to propel you out of survive faster. And one of my favorite power moves is called repurposing and partnering. And in this phase, you look at all of your assets. They could be physical assets like distribution centers or trucks. They could be digital assets. They could be people. And you say, can this asset add the same amount of value to the business now as it could before the shock? Now, if not, who or what could it add value for? And we saw this during COVID. You know, fast fashion companies repurposed their employees to grocery stores. You know, Formula One teams repurposed to make ventilators. And we've seen this in many different aspects. You can do it in all times. You don't need a global crisis, right? You know, another power move is really looking into employee engagement. If you watch closely companies who go into survive, they tend to actually turn that off and focus less on employee engagement because the leadership team gets so heads down, kind of tracking the metrics. And this is where employee engagement becomes strategic. And you've got to really lean in and making sure you're communicating more to your employee base. You know, if you don't give your employees a story, they'll make one up. And usually their story is worse than the actual one. And then your ultimate power move is learning velocity. You know, if you learn faster than others and keep learning during the survive phase, you'll move out of it. You know, what I really see watching companies is that as soon as they get into it, they deprioritize learning. Everything's about hitting the basic numbers and those aspects on the five C's, important but insufficient. If you don't learn faster than others, you're going to get stuck in that. And I think, Chris, that's the biggest trap of survive, is not acknowledging you're going into it, but getting stuck because you never really feel like it's time to move out. So you end up keeping yourself there way longer than you really should. You should already be into the reset. And one of the ways that companies can do this well is called play offense and defense at the same time. So you keep some of your team and survive, but you actively start moving some into reset. And there was a park in Scandinavia who did this in 2020 and 2021. Like the CEO had said, you know, we're stabilized, we're going to move into reset. And he was watching his team at meetings, just, you know, still almost wanting to go back to the old tracking metrics, not really ready to talk about growth. So he split the team. He made an offense team and a defense team. They had separate meetings on separate days of the week, and they only focused either on survive or reset. And they're able to do that with their mind share freed, right? That their colleagues and the other teams were working on their aspect. So that's a real power move too, is kind of separate the offense and the defense so you can actually start moving out of the phase faster than others.
When you are working with clients, how do you help them overcome getting stuck in survival thinking?
That's a great question, Chris. That's a great, great question. One is you want to employ what I call steady state survive, which means before you're actually in survive mode, you're doing the minimum across the five C's. And you actually want to set the metrics for yourself ahead of a crisis time. Say, okay, here's our minimum cash flow. Here's kind of a minimum dependency on any customer. Here's our communication plans. And then when you get into that mode, you already know where you need to be to get back out of it, right? That's why it's one of those power moves, is that if you wait till you're in that, your brain's already sucked down into a different aspect of decision-making. So one is kind of really employing this steady state survive. So you have much less to do when you're triggered and go back into it. Then I like to move people on a little bit before they feel they're ready. Now you've got to have the basics covered. If the basics aren't covered, you should stay there. But you've got to start thinking about those beliefs and moving out of it. And part of that's having that conversation. You've got to give them explicit permission. And that's me to the executives, but more critically, Chris, the executives to their team, is I found you can't casually mention it. You've got to very forcefully give the team the explicit permission that I want us to start focusing on the reset. Like, I know we still feel like we're in survive, but we are stabilized and we're going to be stabilized. Let's start thinking about what that reset will look like as we grow out through the other end. So explicit permission to move is one of the key things that you've got to do.
And what do you feel is most challenging for your clients to deal with when they're in that survival phase?
The emotional drain. You know, we think strategy is about metrics and numbers and communication plans. It's a lot about emotion. It's very difficult to separate the human beings from the strategy or the execution, right, Chris? And survive is emotionally draining on you and your team. Now, paradoxically, what happens in the first phases of survive is you get this adrenaline burst in the organization. And you're saying, hold on, what do you mean? Is that in that first phases, there's sometimes a layoff, right? There's sometimes, you know, cost cuts, but you're united around this purpose that we want to survive as a company. So you actually get that 100% effort from your team. Like, you might've worked in organizations who have this, right? You actually feel this energy like, yes, we're in this together. And as a CEO, you can get lazy. you'd be like, wow, like I've got the, you know, the best engagement I've ever had. I've got all this adrenaline. And if you think back to Reed Hastings' first company, Plus Software, went through this phase. And they describe it as this feeling of being in love, but you almost have this euphoric cloud of like surrounded by all this adrenaline, but you only get that for so long, right? And you've got to be able to manage that emotional journey of your team from the shock and scared to the adrenaline rush, right? That we're in this together to the, is this going to end, right? Am I at a company that's going to reset? And you know you're in there too long when you start to lose key employees, right? When you start to see some of your key talented members go, and that's on you as an executive, because you've not been good enough of communicating your pathway out, and you probably waited too long to start them back on the reset. So again, that emotional energy, and you're going to have to probably, as a CEO, find a great partner to do it with you. You know, maybe that's your head of people, could be somebody else, right? But you can't take all of that on. And that's a trap, Chris, that I see executives fall into, is they try to do the whole thing themselves. They assume everyone else is too busy. Everyone's too slammed. Like, you know, I'm just going to take stuff off my team's plate. Stop, right? You can't do it as one individual. You've got to let your team kind of join you on the process. It's too much for one individual. And again, you're not kind of getting that pulse on the employees that you need by kind of bringing your wider team along with you.
Very true. And you can't ask for this full out effort for a long period of time.
Exactly.
Burn out.
But it feels so good, right? You've got this adrenaline and you think you're going to get it lasting, but when it goes so quickly, right? And that's why I say like the tap on the employee pulse and the adrenaline is so critical. So I like to suggest having one member of the team who that's their job. Their job is to just monitor the employee pulse. Yes, the official surveys are fine, but really that kind of feet on the ground, how are people feeling? What are people saying? And make sure those communication lines are open, because again, you got to soon move into the reset, right? You can't get stuck in this phase. And, you know, board of directors are just as fault here, right? Board of directors often keep companies stuck in this phase way longer than they should. You know, a board is tasked with governance, and governance is great and we need it, right? But boards often want to keep the board meeting agenda on this way longer than it should be. So I recommend doing the same thing there. Assign one board member to own this and let the rest of them kind of start moving on the reset with the team.
And if you are getting some very negative comments in the survey, it probably is much worse, because many people will not say anything negative. They're afraid for their job. They don't want their boss to find out that they said it.
Exactly. That employee survey, your real metric is the participation rate, right? Which is why I already tell companies, right? The number that they give you is one, but what I'm really looking at is what's that participation rate? Because that tells me what the real pulse is on the organization.
So what participation rate tells you?
The participation, like people engage in that survey when they're super engaged or they're super disengaged, right? As you know very well. So very low participation rate says employees have already checked out, right? They're probably dusting off their resumes and looking elsewhere. But if you're waiting until the numbers of the survey to come in to tell you what the pulse is, you've already lost the pulse, right? That should be a metric, but your real metric is kind of your owner of the employee pulse, your leadership team who's working around with people, kind of bringing that back into you.
In dealing with 5 C's during the survival phase, in working with clients, can you share with us some stories of some very challenging situations of dealing with one of those 5 C's?
Yeah, well, cash is king, right, in the survive phase. And what becomes, you know, when it's not just you in survive phase, then cash becomes very difficult because your collections aren't coming in, right? And so you're running this constant, you know, gambit of, you know, are they going to come in enough time to pay my employees? Like, which ones do I have to chase? Which of my suppliers, right, can I not pay in order to kind of get that in? You know, one, you know, the same park that I mentioned earlier, they did something very powerful, actually. And instead of not paying their suppliers, they kind of mapped out their entire ecosystem. And they said, okay, who, if they're not around, we won't have an industry going forward. And then they prioritized paying them, right? Even though they weren't getting cash in the door. And those little moves, kind of, again, they were thinking 2 steps ahead of everybody else, right? Allowed not just them to survive, but really helped building that ecosystem back up with them on board. But, you know, there's many stories I could tell about kind of just how difficult those phases are, but that's why you've got to balance the other C's, right? Making sure you're working with your customers, kind of cost and the communication aspects you can get out of it. And part of doing this well comes from, do your general managers and business unit heads, do they understand how cash flow cycles work? Now that sounds silly, but again, that's not usually something that we train people to do, right? In organizations, we just eventually hand them a P&L and say, go for it. But kind of basic understanding of how accounts payable and accounts receivable work is a really key asset that leaders should have in order for them to be able to help you when you get into the survive phase.
That is so true. Even very senior people often don't understand it. And it is dangerous for the organization when senior people don't understand it. So let's talk about this transition from survival to reset.
Yes, let's talk about the change. Yes, you're going to go into the reset. And the first conversation you're going to have, Chris, is what do we believe to be true? The last conversation you're going to have is what should we do? And it's so tempting to start the reset with that flip chart, right? And you put up on the corner of the room and you get the markers and you say, okay, everyone go put their favorite three priorities on it. Then we'll vote. And then that's what we're going to do. Don't start that way. You always get the list wrong when you start by asking that question. Instead, you start by saying, what do we believe to be true? How is our industry going to change? How are we going to change? What are the key trends most shaping us? The majority of companies that I meet have never had that conversation. Now, they've got PowerPoint decks upon PowerPoint decks of trends, and they've sat through multiple consultancy sessions on the mega trends. But as a team, they've never said, what are our beliefs? How do we see these things going forward? Let's take this forward 3 to 6 years. What are the ones that are going to impact us the most? Really isolate those top 5 or 6 trends and then articulate your beliefs on them. Now, this is hard because to articulate a good belief, you've got to articulate it in a way you could get it wrong. And Chris, most of us don't like to do that. So we end up articulating very vague beliefs, right? You know, like, I believe employers should care about their employees, or I believe that the macroeconomic situation will be volatile. That's not helping strategy, right? Like, tell me, what's your actual belief? You know, will interest rates come down in a way that mortgages are affordable and talent has more flexibility? You know, will supply chains return to kind of pre-COVID levels, or will we be resetting what's normal in terms of expectations as far as shipment rates? Like, have those conversations. Now, the first thing you'll find is you don't agree on everything. That's also okay, right? Because where we don't agree is where we need to start actively testing on some of those beliefs. But that's the first conversation you're going to have. What do we believe to be true? And how might this change? Because one of our power moves of Thrive, we're going to flash forward a little bit, is while we're executing our priorities, we're actually testing our beliefs. Now, this is going back to consultancies where I know many of your listeners are. This is a great place that your consultancies can help with, like helping you kind of track trends and track beliefs and kind of have these discussions. But small firms can do this too. You can do this on an Excel sheet, right? Just kind of put up your top trends and beliefs and have a shared document and have people kind of input things in as they see the situation around them changing. But this is where I encourage every team to start, including yours, Chris, right? What do we believe to be true? How is our industry going to morph and shape going forward? And what does that mean for us?
We constantly have the discussions. It's on top of mind. It's so important. I wonder, what are some of the ways you have those discussions with clients? Some questions you always ask, maybe tools you use?
Yeah, so I like to start by really separating the trends, things that we're seeing, from our beliefs. How do we see that going forward? And this is a skill set, right? Talking about the strategy skills that we're trying to build. This is one of the big ones in the reset, is articulating a good belief. So a trend is something that I'm seeing, right? So I might see that there's more pushes for carbon policies in the construction industry. You know, I might see kind of we're talking about sustainability more in construction. Now that's a trend. Now, most people write down their belief of, you know, we will talk about sustainability in construction. That's not a clear enough belief to make choices on, right? So a belief could be, I believe there will be more conversation about carbon neutrality in construction, but developers and GCs will not be willing to pay more for it. Or I could take the belief, we'll have more conversation. GCs and developers will not be willing to pay more for it, but we won't be able to hire top talent if we don't have a firm stance on where we're going to be in carbon neutrality. Now that's a belief, right? I've said, yes, our customers aren't going to be paying more if we change our scope here, but if we want to hire top talent, we're going to have to do something more than other people. And what I like to do, and now again, this is simple, right? This is no complicated tools, no Excel sheets. I just take a flip chart and I write this sentence. I write, I am seeing XXX and I believe YYY through 2027. And you force the team to separate what I'm seeing right now from what I believe to be true going forward. One of the first things you'll notice when you do this is we're very near-term thinkers. People tend to think kind of 6 months in advance, but strategy, as you know, is a 3 to 5 year thing, right? So really pushing to think 3 years is one of those skill sets that you've got to start building and developing. And it doesn't happen in one workshop. You know, most teams, it takes 2 to 3, sometimes 4 times of having the trends and belief discussion where they've really kind of gone up that learning curve of developing the skill set.
And in this situation that you mentioned, maybe one of the questions to ask is maybe there's another type of customer we want to start attracting so we can actually hire top talent.
Exactly, exactly. So then you say, okay, well, so what's the so what? Like, so what are the implications for us? Okay, if our current customers aren't willing to pay, you know, are there other market opportunities for us, right? Are we not looking in the right place? Are we going to be able to open markets in doing this, right? So is this about our geography? Is this about our type of construction? Is this about the customers that we're targeting? Are we looking at the wrong life cycle of our customers, right? Should we be going to the influencers, the architects, and the designers who do care a lot more, right? And then they'll convince the customers with us. And this is, see, you're going into all of those really critical strategy choices, but you're starting with the foundation. So as the choices are working or not working, we can go back to the beliefs and say, are our beliefs panning out? You know, are those beliefs that we articulated, are those the ones that we're seeing as we execute in the real world, right? And your beliefs form choices. Those are the foundation. Not to overuse our construction metaphor, but you've got to build a house on a foundation, right? And your beliefs as a team are the foundation for your strategy. Start there, or you know what? You're going to argue about all of the other choices in the strategy process if you haven't started by aligning on those beliefs.
In terms of challenges of reset phase, we spoke about that some people get stuck in survival and it's difficult to pull them along. What are some of the other key challenges you noticed with clients?
So one of the challenges of the reset phase is rushing it, right? And you rush it because you've been in survive and you want to get on with it, right? And there's this real, very entrepreneurial notion of, you know, we just got to get on with it. You know, great execution versus great strategy, all of those things that we keep batting about, they're useless arguments, right? You can't separate them in the real world. Strategy, execution, culture, try to separate them in the real world. You can't, right? I don't know why at business schools we still teach these on separate weeks, like they're the very distinct things. So rushing it, you know, getting on with it is great in some aspects, but not here, because if you haven't made the choices, what are you getting on with? Right? It's what I always say. So kind of, no, but otherwise, you don't also want to get stuck there, right? You can analyze for too long, because sometimes teams are waiting for that breakthrough moment. They think at some part in the discussions, they're going to get this massive aha and like, that's it, right? It's almost like the light opening down and coming from above. That doesn't happen that often either. So it's like that Goldilocks thing. Spend long enough to get the insights, but not so long that you're stuck. The other thing that I really see is this notion of my team's too busy. You know, my team's too busy, so I'll just do it myself, the leaders will say. You know, like I would love for them to do it, but you know, they're so busy doing their jobs. Like, we don't have time for strategy. And I think that's the biggest issue strategy has in organizations, is it's never urgent, right? Of all the steps you have to do that day, you know, looking at those strategy choices is never the most urgent thing, right? So it always gets pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And then you end up spending more time-wise calendar in the quote unquote strategy process, but you haven't really given it the mind share, right? Because it's always the last thing at the day, then the last thing at the week, and the thing that just gets scrambled before you have to meet your team again. And you've got to set aside the time and give yourself that explicit permission to really think, right? I mean, maybe your team has amazing breakthroughs the first 10 minutes that you sit down, but most teams I work with, it takes them a little longer to really break through and get some of those insights.
And during the reset phase and those discussions, how much time do you spend on thinking and talking about differentiation and how that should be adjusted?
Yeah, differentiation, that's the sweet spot of strategy. And I don't know what happened when we got so vague and generic about this topic, right? But we have overcomplicated competitive advantage and differentiation, and we've likened it to very tactical things about being customer-centric or having talented employees or being innovative, all the things that every company in every industry says that they do, right? Is having differentiation is simple but powerful, and it comes from being able to say, do we have things that others don't? Can we do things that others can't? Can we build moats around our advantage? Now, those sound like three really simple things I said, right? But if you really start going through your organization, say, what do we have that no one else does? What can we do that no one else can? How can we build moats around your advantage? That list is really short. And that list gets shorter when you start figuring out, well, what of all these things is going to actually be hard for someone else to imitate? In every reset that I've done, this conversation has been the most emotive, right? It's been the one that not necessarily took the most time, but probably drained brains the most. And you sometimes leave this conversation feeling really good. Like you've gone through everything and you say, you know what? I actually feel very comfortable. We have a right to win going forward. More times than not, teams leave the conversation not feeling great, right? And they realize that, yeah, we used to have a competitive advantage, but after the world we're in just reset, I don't know if we have one going forward. Now, that's not bad news because strategy's job is to build one going forward. But if you don't let yourself sit in that feeling for a minute, right? And have a tough conversation. Yes, we built a great organization and it's still a great organization, but how we won before is not going to be how we win going forward. And we've got to build something new. If you don't have the guts to have that conversation, the reset's going to be pretty difficult, right? You're going to find yourself going back to this cycle much faster because you haven't built anything that's harder for others to imitate. So let that one sit and then accept the answer, right? Don't try to sugarcoat us. And I always say, don't be too easy of a grader. Don't be a hard grader, but don't be too easy of a grader. Then we can talk about in strategy, what do we need to strengthen or buy or build going forward to have that right to win after this?
Can you share one or two examples of a situation where you worked with a client and they had to find another way to differentiate themselves because of what happened and during survival and what basically triggered the survival, and now they're at reset, but they need to find another way to differentiate?
Yeah, I mean, so many, Chris. So one of my favorite examples of this is a supplier to the OEMs, so the big car companies, and they're based in the US and the Midwest. And if you think about the last couple of years, right, their industry, you know, Ford, GM, et cetera, are slowly transitioning to EV, but, you know, less slowly than some original beliefs. And this company used to have the most incredible right to win, is that they were better than anyone in the US, arguably the world, at taking down the end-to-end unit cost logistics. They would bring in kitting and fulfillment from all over the world, put them in boxes and send them to dealerships. And Chris, they were better than anyone at reducing these unit costs. But if your core customer is General Motors and Ford, you know what? Over time, that's just table stakes, right? They expect that from all their suppliers to have kind of very great end-to-end unit logistics. And so when this team sat down in 2021, they realized, okay, our beliefs say the industry is declining, right? As we transition to EV, our right to win has gone from a right to win to table stakes. And so we have declining advantage in a declining industry. Right? That's a tough conversation, right? And then when you push and realize, okay, hold on. Yes, we have a declining advantage in a declining industry, but you know what industry this advantage is really, really cool to? All of these e-commerce businesses that have spun up after COVID. They want to focus on the front end, sales and marketing to their customers. They don't want to focus on the back end fulfillment. We can take our old sweet spot, which we still have, it's just less interesting to our current customers, and we're going to merge it to a new industry. So almost think if they took this back and they said, okay, we're going to actually go provide this to this new industry, spun out a new business unit where this right to win became powerful again. So that's one of my favorite stories because you acknowledge it and you said, hold on though, I see a growth opportunity. We're just looking at the wrong industry. And so that's one of my favorite stories. And there's so many others. You know, there's some where you look down and you say, hey, we don't have a single thing that provides us a right to win, but we have three or four things that together could be hard to imitate. We're going to focus ruthlessly on bundling these three things together. That way competitors can look at us, but they'll never be able to disentangle how we put together our brand and our customer service and our partnership approach and our delivery. It's like you can be able to pick out the points, but not all of them together. And the third thing you didn't ask about, but I want to tie it back to earlier, is culture. Can culture be a right to win, right? Because that feels like the easy one. We'll just put that down and say, yes, we have a competitive advantage. We have a great, strong culture. Rarely, Chris, it rarely is a right to win. Now, it's important, right? And for all companies, it's important. A lot of companies have a strong culture, but there's very few I've seen where you could actually say our culture provides a strategic competitive advantage. And one of those companies is WD-40, right? You know, that iconic blue and yellow can. Is building that culture was one of the very first priorities when Gary Ridge became CEO over 25 years ago, still held by the current CEO, Steve Brass. And just that day-to-day focus on, we want to build culture across our entire ecosystem, not just our employees, who we call tribe members, but through our suppliers and stakeholders and partners. And, you know, through their lived values, through their servant leadership, through their learning, through their employee engagement, they have built something which, you know, has really held. And you can see it empirically. You know, in their last 30 years, they've never done a layoff, right? They've been able to build this culture and just keep preserving it over time. So a tough conversation, but there's always an answer. And that's why I love this conversation. There's always an answer if you're willing to have the conversation.
I think that our listeners would want me to ask you, what would be your advice for people looking to stay relevant and successful in their careers in the long term, given all the changes that are happening in the world, AI, technologies, all the things that are happening, cultural shifts, any thoughts that you have?
Yes, anyone can stay relevant. Your key differentiator is going to be learning velocity. And I'm not saying that as a professor, right? I'm not saying that kind of in this discussion, is that if you think about all of these changes going around from AI to digital, et cetera, what you'll quickly realize is that a lot of it's going to be commoditized. A lot of skill sets or competencies that organizations build are going to be copied. And it's the same as individuals. But learning velocity, that those things compound on itself over time. And this is one of the key differentiators of high performing companies. It's a key differentiator of people who excel in their careers, right? Can you learn faster than others? Now, learning doesn't mean sitting in front of a screen and taking a lot of courses. That's a piece of it, but that's not it. It's about consistently focusing on experimentation and closing learning loops and embedding and sharing learning. That's the ultimate differentiator. And I've seen it time and time again across every industry, across every size of company, across every culture. That actually builds the ultimate competitive advantage for both a company and an individual.
And what are your predictions for the future based on what's happening with development of AI right now?
Well, the one thing that I know is that I can't predict the future, right? So that I do know, but I do have some beliefs, right? Is what I focus kind of companies to think about. Now, the first thing to really make better beliefs about AI is to split them, is you've got to split how AI will change your industry from how AI should be incorporated into your strategy versus how you can get operational efficiencies from AI. And I don't see very many teams who are great at parsing those three conversations, right? Is most teams, and I probably had this conversation four times already this week, and I think it's what, Tuesday, is, oh, AI won't affect our industry, Rebecca. You just don't understand our industry. You know, we're so manual, we're so regulated. You know, people profit from our inefficiencies. I hear this time and time again, right? The same thing I heard for digital, the same thing I heard for ESG, right? So force the conversation about our industry. I do believe that all industries will be impacted dramatically by AI, but at much different timeframes. Then what about our strategy? We don't need an AI strategy, right? But we do need to look at how we're going to create value and see how can AI enable, support, and accelerate it. And then finally, take those quick wins. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing lots of quick wins around the organization. And as an employee, if your company's not doing anything, why aren't you, right? The amount of free learning and tools on AI is incredible. Like this is something that 10, 20, 30 years ago, we never had anything close to this free learning you can have now. And I've talked to some employees in the last few weeks who said, Rebecca, I would love to do this, but my company has explicitly said, you know, we're not going to do anything on AI. But why aren't you, right, outside of the company time and off, why aren't you playing with some of these Gen AI tools? Why aren't you taking one of these free courses? Because whether or not you stay at that organization, this is a skill set that you're going to want to have, again, going back to that learning velocity we spoke about earlier, to learn faster, to grow faster.
Could you share how you use AI in your work? I think that would be an interesting thing for people.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got to practice what you preach, right? It'd be terrible if I said I never use it. So one, I am obsessed, hopefully healthily, right, with this notion of high growth and high performance. So I'm always thinking about ways to accelerate it. So in every organization that I work with, I look across those two needles of value creation, and I try to identify where are those couple of ways that AI will really increase willingness to pay? Where are those couple of ways AI will really reduce costs? And I try to bucket those out. And then what I do is I walk through an organization's value chain, and every step of the value chain, I try to identify those two opportunities. So that's on the organization side, value creation and value chain. Personally, it's about forcing yourself into the habit of using it, even where you yourself could do it better, right? Are you still using the tools, right, to help just kind of learn them? So, you know, I don't need help writing emails, but once in a while, I should put something in a Gen AI tool just to see what it does, right? Is I'm a great note taker, but should I turn on the AI note taking tool for all of my calls and have that help me? Yes, because you know what? I'm helping teams understand you can train the AI tool to help take better notes. Like how can you put stuff verbally into the conversation to help it do better? Where I'm really playing now with Chris is the language translations. I work with a lot of teams who English is their second, third, fourth, sometimes fifth language. And how can we use some of these tools to not just have live translation during sessions, would enable all of our documents and communications to go so much faster and better. So really the chat and the language translation are where I'm using it the most, and then really playing with how it can do some of these bigger value creating things. And, you know, and I'm working in industries from concrete. I'm super obsessed with what it's doing in that industry, to fashion, to food and retail. So you can't give me an industry that I can't already identify a handful of use cases we're playing with right now.
What are some of your favorite tools, if you could mention?
As far as AI tools?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, all the basic free ones are ones that you can start playing with, right? So you don't have to pick a favorite, right? I'll get in trouble if I choose any of them, but you can play with OpenAI or Microsoft's or Facebook's or Bard, right? Play with whatever tool that you want. And again, just start practicing. You know, I like to play with a couple different slide ones, you know, play with Beautiful AI or another one like that. There are several different translation ones. So I use a handful across all of them, because not one is going to be able to do everything that you want. And also, I want to be versed in all of the tools so I can have better conversations with companies who are using different ones of them as well.
Thank you, Rebecca. Yeah. Where can our listeners learn more about you, your recent book, where they can buy it, can learn more about your work and so on? Anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks, Chris. Yeah, so the book comes out on February 27th in the USA, and it's called Survive, Reset, Thrive. And it's available everywhere that you buy books, including Amazon and Target and all the other ones. And then I've got a website, survivereset.thrive.com. And then you'll see videos, articles, links to the books, and ways to kind of keep in touch with all the case studies as well. So several of the case studies that we mentioned today are available on the website as well.
Thank you, Rebecca. So great to have you with us today.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Great conversation.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Our podcast sponsor today is strategytraining.com. If you want to strengthen your strategy skills, you can get the overall approach used in well-managed strategy studies. It is a free download. Go to firmsconsulting.com/overall approach. And if you are working on your resume at this time, even senior people need to have a resume sometimes, get a free download. It is McKinsey and BCG winning resume. Go to firmsconsulting.com/resume PDF. Thank you, everyone, again for tuning in, and I'll see you all at the next session.